We're in Revelation chapter 21, which is a very encouraging chapter. It's the most detailed description of heaven that we have in the whole Bible. And it's very encouraging, obviously, to read about that. We get to read about the glories of the eternal home that God has prepared for us, where He wants us all to be with Him forever and ever. And as we started at this chapter and that new heaven and new earth, holy city, the new Jerusalem, came down from God out of heaven as a bride adorned for her husband. And then that voice of God came forth and with that promise that He would dwell with His people and in that city and be their God, and that we will be His people there. From that point through the end of the chapter, he's going to be describing even in much more detail. But those opening verses, and then we had verse 4 that tells us many of the things that are here on this earth that will not be there in our new home. It's very, very encouraging to read in verse 4 that God will wipe away all tears from our eyes. There will be no more death, no sorrow, no crying. There will be no more pain, no more final exams. none of those things. That's for a few of our people in here that are having to suffer through that pain right now. But all of those things that we associate with this earth, those things that are painful, those unpleasant things, all that's going to be gone. He says those former things will be passed away. So is God making, or has He prepared a home for us for eternity that's better than this temporary place that He's given us to dwell in right now? Much greater. No comparison, in fact. So we get to read about that here. And our life here is short, as we know, and we have to look forward to all eternity ahead of us. And rather than that being a discouraging thing to think that we have to leave this life, this world, one day, when we read about what God has in store for us, should that be something that really makes us sad to think about? Or should we not have lots of hope that God gives us by reading this? And so He's given us this chapter for that purpose. And then we get down to verse 7. We saw there that, yes, there are conditions for being able to be there. He tells us, here's what you have to do. Here's how you have to live in order for one day for you to be with me in this place. And he says, he that overcomes will inherit all things. And so we went into detail about that last time and how God has not called us to failure. He's not called us to be ones who spiritually fail, and we know we have lost our share of battles against Satan with temptation, but the Lord has provided a way for us to come out of that and to overcome that. And He says if we will do that, as He's made it possible for us to do, then we will inherit all things. So then in verse 8, and this is where we left off last time, before He moves ahead with the great detailed description of that city four square that we will have starting there in verse 9 to carry right down to the end of the chapter. Before that, He also now mentions what we better not be doing, or what those things that will prevent us from going to that place. So when we read about this great place that God has prepared, where He desires for us all to be, but He doesn't say everyone will be there, because He tells us right here, here are things that if we do those things, we won't be there. And as we mentioned last time, when God is describing heaven like this, and then He says, here's what you need to do, but here's what you must not do. Well, those are things that we want to very much have in our minds and in our understanding, that we could be thinking about not just every now and then, but on a daily basis, reminding ourselves of how we need to live in this world and what we have to overcome, the things that we have to stay away from. Now, as we also mentioned, verse 8 is not an exhaustive or a complete list of all the things that will keep us out of heaven. But he does highlight some major things that we need to be keenly aware of and make sure that we're not doing. All right, so the first one that we started looking at last time is being fearful. But let's go ahead and read Revelation 21:8, get the whole verse there, and then we'll try to go through that some more here. Brother Dave, can you read that for us, please?
"But the fearful and unbelieving, the abominable, and murderers, and whoremongers, and sorcerers, and idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death."
Okay, so who's not going to be in heaven? Who's going to have their part in this lake that burns with fire and brimstone, the second death? Well, he says the fearful, first of all. And that may take us by surprise to read that. Fearful. Is that something we think of frequently that is a problem that we better be aware of? I mean, that's probably not one of those things that tends to be perhaps at the forefront of our minds, but it needs to have our attention, because the Lord says the fearful are not going to be in this city four square. The fearful are going to have their part in the lake of fire. So what does this mean to be fearful? Well, the word, as we noted last time, it means to be timid. It comes from the word to dread, but it means to be timid. And of course, he's talking about in the spiritual sense. We considered an example where this word is used in the New Testament, the same Greek word there, and that's in Matthew chapter 8. Let's go ahead and read Matthew 8, 23 through 27 to see this example, because here's an example of fearfulness, the very word that he uses there in Revelation 21. So if we want to see an application of it in practice, here it is. And there'll be some other teachings from the Lord in this passage. But Matthew chapter 8, 23 through 27. See, Brother Glenn, can you read that?
"And when he was entered into a ship, his disciples followed him. And behold, there arose a great tempest in the sea, insomuch that the ship was covered with the waves, but he was asleep. And his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, Lord, save us, we perish. And he said unto them, Why are you fearful, O ye of little faith? Then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. But the men marveled, saying, What manner of man is this, that even the winds and the sea obey him?"
Okay, now is the Lord teaching here that there's no possibility that anything like a terrible storm or some other tragedy could befall a Christian? Is that what he's teaching in this passage? No, that's not what he's teaching in this passage. Is it possible that a great storm could do us harm or even bring about our death? That could happen, and it does happen to people. He's not teaching that that can't happen. He's also not teaching that that we should desire that to happen or not to desire that it wouldn't happen or something like that. But his apostles were afraid at this time. And there's also something we need to remember. He called his apostles for a purpose. When God makes promises, then we're in a different realm. And the Lord had made promises to his apostles. What is the word apostle? What does that mean? I mean, that's a transliteration, that word in English. It's from the Greek word apostolos. But what does the word mean? It's one who is sent. And so Jesus called and named, chose those apostles to be sent. To do what? They were going to be sent forth into all the world to preach the gospel, to bear witness of the resurrected Christ. Now, at this point in time, they didn't fully understand all those things and what their lives were going to be like, but the Lord did promise them that they had a work to do for him. And he himself had a work to do. I mean, was Jesus going to end up dying in a shipwreck and drown or something? Was that going to happen? No, that wasn't God's will. God had a purpose for his son to come into this world, and he had a very specific purpose for the death that he would die. It wasn't going to be in some ship on the Sea of Galilee in a big storm. Neither would the apostles perish in that way. That was something that the Lord had given by promise. Jesus understood that. Well, here the apostles in that ship at this point are fearful for their lives. Well, did they need to be? If they really stopped and thought about what their purpose was, who had chosen them, who was with them, and what they were supposed to be doing. I mean, here they are out on the sea going across to do more preaching. What did they need to be afraid of? I mean, that just was not something that they should have had in their hearts here. But it says that they, that great tempest arose in the sea. The waves were going over the ship, and they woke Jesus was asleep. And they woke him up and pleading with him to save them, saying, "We perish." And so he says, "Why are you fearful, O you of little faith?" All right, so here's where the word faith comes in. All right, where does faith come from? And I know we hit this all the time, but that should be something we always remember. Where does faith come from? Faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. So for us to have faith in God is going to come by hearing the things that he's told us. And of course, in this case, the Lord had promised. He had spoken to them his promises about what they were going to do. So they had the Lord's word that they had heard, and with faith in that word, they shouldn't be afraid of a storm right now. Jesus wasn't. He could sleep right through it. He was not worried about, well, he might die in this storm. He knew better. He believed what his Father had promised. And so he's encouraging his disciples here to believe the Lord's word. And here's the problem with being afraid. This kind of fearful, here's a spiritual timidity when they lost their faith in what God said. And so now they were afraid to do the Lord's will because they weren't believing what he said. So is this kind of fearfulness that he's talking about here, is it an obstacle to faith? Yeah, it goes against it. So that's why we had the way of faith. But now here, this is the way of fearfulness that's going to be something, as we can see in this case, that will go along with a lack of faith in what God has said. And I know Brother Lawrence brought up another example of this from the Old Testament last week. And when the 12 spies were sent into the land of Canaan to spy out the land, God had given them a promise. He had promised that he was going to deliver that land to them. He had promised that to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And through Moses, he had given that promise to them again, had brought them out of Egypt, the Exodus. He had brought all those 10 plagues upon the Egyptians, where they left with great spoil. And then he parted the Red Sea before them, and they crossed on the dry land. And then he brought the sea upon the Egyptians as they pursued them, destroyed them. He was feeding them. I mean, as soon as they got in the wilderness, 3 days in, they started murmuring and complaining about a lack of food and water. The God that had done all of that to bring them out of Egypt from their bondage there was, as he put it in Exodus 17, was God's arm shortened? That he couldn't furnish a table in the wilderness? How could the God that did all of that would then bring them out there so they would starve or thirst to death? So all that murmuring the Israelites did over and over again was exactly this, that fearfulness, lack of faith in God's promises when they were murmuring and complaining about a lack of food. Well, what did God do to feed them in the wilderness? Manna. They had that manna from heaven. 40 years he sustained their lives. That would fall 6 days out of the week and a double share on Friday night so that they wouldn't have to gather on the Sabbath day, so it would sustain them for those 2 days. On Friday morning, they would have two portions, but it was enough for their food to supply them 7 days a week. Did that all those weeks, all those years, 40 years, provided for them. He brought water out of the rocks to give them drink. What could God not do to provide for them? Why was he going to let them come out in the wilderness and starve to death or thirst to death? That was not his will. He told them he was going to give them the land. And he told them their enemies would fall before them if they kept his commandments. The spies go into the land. They see the giants there. They see the number, the size of the people, their numbers, the great walls they had around their cities like Jericho. And what happened later? We know when they crossed Jordan River, Jericho was the first city on the west side of Jordan that they fought against. Before they even did that, they came up on the east side of Jordan and they fought those two Amorite kings, Sihon and Og. You ever read the description of Og's bed? It was huge. He was one of those giants. Sihon and Og were among those giants. They were that 10 of those spies were so afraid of when they saw them. They saw the size of those people. Well, what was the size of a man to God? I mean, God made that man and made those men that big. What was their size to him? Nothing. How about their number? How about the walls of their cities? I mean, we have so many examples of what he did later. How about that giant that faced David? Did David care about Goliath's size? See, he's the opposite of those 10 of those 12 spies. David was right along there with Joshua and Caleb with faith. God promised he was going to give them victory over their enemies. Did they believe that? Well, Joshua did, Caleb did, David did, Jonathan, the son of Saul, did, and there are many others that had faith. But what about those 10 spies? They went and said, we can't take the land. They're too big. Their cities are too strong. There's too many of these people. And they caused the people to murmur. They didn't believe what God said. They were afraid. And that's when God said, no more. And he said they would not enter into the land of Canaan. And that generation, he swore in his wrath that they would not enter into his rest. And so later on, of course, he rewarded Joshua and Caleb because they said, we can take this land. They believe what God said, no fear. The fear was on the side of those 10, just like it had been with that whole generation of Israelites so many times. Later on, we read about King Saul, 1 Samuel chapter 17, that chapter about David and Goliath. Well, there's that great giant. And here's the king, Saul. Of course, he was a big man himself, but not compared to Goliath. But did he have different words than Joshua and Caleb had that they had believed in so many years before? Did Saul have different words from God, or did he lack the words and lack the promises from God that Joshua and Caleb had? He had the same word, he had the same promises, but he didn't believe either. He was afraid. He was on that mountain afraid. 40 days, he and all that army were afraid, fearful. No faith in God. And then David comes along. Here's a shepherd boy sent by his father to bring food to his three brothers who were in the army. And he comes in there and he hears Goliath. And what does he do? That was an offense to David's ears to hear that Philistine blaspheming God. And he says, is there not a cause? And he's ready to go fight him. Saul puts his armor on him. David took that off, went there in his shepherd's clothing with his bag, put those 5 stones in it from the brook, but had his staff in his hand and his sling. He believed what God said, and he believed that with his faith in God, that Goliath was going to fall. And he told Goliath that that was going to happen. He said, I'm going to take your head from off of you. And he said, and this is so that all Israel will know that there is a God in Israel, and that it's his fight. So he was doing this for the sake, David did that for the sake of the faith of the whole nation. And God rewarded that. There's someone who had faith and no fear. We remember the parable of the talents. And of those three in that parable in Matthew chapter 25 that we read about there, they weren't all given the same thing. That is, they weren't all given the same number of talents. There was one that had 5. There was one that had two and another one one. It tells us that in Matthew chapter 25 and verse 15. So the one who gave them that those talents went on a journey. And then he came back later and for them to give account to him of what they had done with his goods. The one that had five talents, what did he have to produce for his master when he returned? In verse 20 of Matthew 25. He produced five more talents with that. The one that had two, what did he produce with that? Two more. In both those cases, the Lord told them that they had done well. They were good and faithful servants. And because they had been faithful over a few things, he was going to make them rulers over many things. And he said, enter into the joy of thy Lord. The one that had one talent, what did he produce? Nothing. Why not? Yeah, why? He said, Lord, I knew thee that thou art a hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown and gathering where thou hast not strewed, and I was afraid and went and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, there thou hast that is thine. What prevented him from serving his Lord? His fear. He didn't have faith, he had fear, and that fear was an obstacle for him to do the Lord's will. Just like in those examples we have from the Old Testament, just like that one case with the apostles. And of course, as we know, Jesus taught his apostles to strengthen their faith. And did their faith grow? Now, we've all had moments of fear where we didn't have our faith as we should. But the Lord is encouraging us to have stronger faith. And we can see that if we don't, and if we continue in being fearful and not having our faith and not serving the Lord as we should because of that, if we're like this one talent man, if we're like those 10 spies, if we're like Saul and those fearful Israelites and whatever other examples we have from Scripture like that, and there are many, then we're going to end up not entering into that eternal city that God has prepared for us. So that one is one that we need to be very aware of, but much of that is involved in really the issue or the subject of faith, because those ones who are fearful did not have their faith in God. And with that, we can understand why that's such a major thing. Let's turn to John chapter 14 and verse 27. Just a couple more verses before we move on here. John 14 and verse 27. See, Brother Lawrence, can you read that for us, please? Yes.
Peace I leave with you. My peace I give you. I do not give you as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled, and do not be afraid.
And see, we have the Lord's promise, and we have lots of them. The Lord tells us that that promise, Romans 8:28. That he will work all things together for our good if we love him and are called according to his purpose. He's promised us in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13 that he is faithful. He will not allow us to be tempted above what we can bear at any point in our lives. He says that he will always provide a way of escape that we can bear the temptation. We have the Lord's promises in all of these things, and he says that we should not let our heart be troubled or be afraid. We have no reason to be. Job said that though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. And I mean, have any Christians lost their lives because of their faith in the Lord and serving him? Yeah, I mean, that's what the book of Revelation is about. I mean, the people that were originally was written to, many of them had that happen. And they were seeing it happen to their brethren. But here he's telling them, don't be afraid. Don't be fearful. Don't stop serving the Lord because you don't trust in him and don't believe his promises. Ultimately, we've seen it over and over again in Revelation, though, with those examples and how in the end the Lord's people are going to triumph. If we continue to serve Him, even if it cost us our life here, we know the Lord has a reward in store for us in eternity. And those ones, and we've seen so many times in our study of Revelation, those ones that were martyred, beheaded, and all of those terrible things, He gives us the picture of them in the hereafter and what they have. And so who prevails in the end? It's the Lord's people. Do we believe in Him? Well, we need to. We must. Let's look also at 2 Timothy 1 and verse 7. Brother Aaron, 2 Timothy 1, 7.
God has not given us the spirit of fear, but the power and love and of a sound mind.
All right. So has God given us a spirit of fear? No. Now, let me get... this is an important thing we're going to do here, so I'm not just playing around, but let's bring in another aspect. We're reading about all this. Don't fear. Don't have fear. Fearfulness will cost us our souls. All right, what's the whole duty of man? Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 13.
Fear God and keep His commandments.
Fear God and keep His commandments. And now, do we think, well, how does that fit together when He says don't have fear, when He says that fearing God and keeping His commandments is the whole... is the conclusion of the whole matter, the whole duty of man. Acts chapter 10 and verses 34 and 35. Brother Samuel, can you read that? Acts 10, 34 and 35. Who's going to be accepted by God? I mean, what he says here is exactly what he teaches there in Ecclesiastes 12, 13 in the Old Testament. No different here.
Then Peter opened his mouth and said, but in every nation, he that feareth them worketh righteousness is accepted with them.
And we could go on and on with this. So we have a lot of scriptures that tell us we have to fear, and then all these ones that say don't fear. Now that right there tells us those are two different kinds of fears, aren't they? There's a kind we have to have, and there's a kind we must not have. So we've spent the bulk of our time here looking at this kind of fear that we must not have, that will be an obstacle to our having faith in God and serving Him as He's taught us to do. That's not fear of the Lord that He tells us not to have here. Fearing God is a different kind of fear. That's not a fear that paralyzes us or keeps us from serving the Lord as He's told us. In fact, it's what we have to have in order to have faith and serve Him. Ultimately, the fear of the Lord is what? And I'm not going to give you my own definition. What's that? Well, it certainly involves that. Just looking at it from a definition standpoint from Scripture, we have Proverbs 8 and verse 13, where he says, the fear of the Lord is to hate evil. So that's part of the definition of it. The best, the most extensive definition that we have of that fear of the Lord. Travis, I should put you on the spot and ask you to tell me the verses. I know you could sing it. Psalm 34, right? So no, you don't have to sing it right now, but Psalm 34, why don't you read... why don't you read verses 11 to 14? And he's really defining, describing what the fear of the Lord is, and we have to have this. This is really the opposite of this kind of fear that would cost us our souls that he's told us not to have. Okay, go ahead, Trav.
Come ye children, hearken unto me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. What man is he that desireth life and loveth many days that he may see good? Keep thy tongue from evil and thy lips from speaking guile. Depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it.
All right, so he says, come and I'll teach it to you. What does he teach? Well, that first of all, for us to desire life and love many days, and he doesn't say period, because if he put a period right there, then we'd be just like everybody else in the world. I mean, how many people in the world desire life and would love to have many days? In other words, how many people would like to live a long life on this earth? Everybody? But he's talking about our reason for that desire, what we're living those days for. Now that will make us very different from the world if we have the fear of the Lord. That we desire life and love many days that we may see good. See, there's our purpose for living. We should desire, we want to see more of what's good. I mean, and who's the definer of that? When that rich young man came to Jesus and said, "Good master, what good thing shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And he says, "Why callest thou me good? There is none good but one, that is God." There's one source of good. There's one definer of good, and that's our Creator. So when we desire life and love many days that we may see good, where are we going to see that? Where has the Lord revealed to us what is good? Where is the righteousness of God revealed? According to Romans 1:16. "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith." It's here in the Scriptures, in God's Word. So if we want to see what's good, that's given to us by God in His Word. I mean, I'm not going to wake up tomorrow in the night or something like that with God directly speaking in my ear, telling me something that's good that's not in His Word. I mean, where we're going to hear Him or see His definition of good is in this Word that He's given to us. So we want to see more of that. We want to know more of the will of God. We want to understand more of His will. We want to have a greater understanding and knowledge of what's good in His sight, what pleases Him. If that's what we're desiring to live for, then how much time are we going to spend in His Word? Hungering and thirsting for righteousness. We're going to be digging into His Word to see these hid treasures that He has in there so we can learn more of what pleases Him. So we're going to be in that all the time. If we had the fear of the Lord, we're going to do that. And as we saw in Proverbs 8:13, the fear of the Lord is to hate evil. And He said, what do we do with that good that we see? We need to keep our tongues from evil and our lips from speaking guile. So if we see the good, the right way to use our tongues, that's a hard thing, to use our tongues in a right way. Ephesians 4:29, "Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying." Now, how easy is it to do that, to have nothing corrupt come out, but everything that we speak is good, that's going to build others up? That's not easy to do. But how much good, how much do we have to search in the Scriptures to see that good and then apply that even to our tongues? I mean, James chapter 3 is a full chapter on the difficulty of bridling our tongues. But with our faith in God, it can be done through Him and His strength. But we have to see what that is. And then, if we don't love to do what we're seeing of that good and hate to do evil, are we going to do that? So the fear of the Lord, it requires that love of righteousness and doing what's good in the sight of God and hating that evil. And that's why He says that we will depart from evil and do good. So we have to do the good that we see. And if we hate evil, we're going to turn away from that evil. So it should be obvious why that fear of the Lord, which is what that is something that is absolutely necessary for us to go to this great city, eternal dwelling place where God is in heaven one day for our eternity. But if we have that other kind of fear that will prevent us from having faith in God and serving Him, then that would keep us from being able to enter that place. All right, well, the next thing that we see in Revelation 21, verse 8, the unbelieving. Is there a connection? Well, we've already seen that. If we're fearful, I mean, we're not going to have faith like we need to. But whatever the reason is, if we don't believe God, how are we going to be able to be with Him in heaven? One of the strongest, most direct scriptures on that point that we can find in God's Word is Hebrews 11 and verse 6. Brother Michael, can you read that? Hebrews 11 and verse 6.
For without faith it is impossible to please him, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek.
Can we please God without faith? He says it's impossible. So if we don't have faith, if we don't believe, then we cannot please him. How are we going to be where he is for eternity? That should be fairly obvious that without faith, since we can't please him without it, that there's no way that we could be with him in eternity if we don't have that. So the unbelievers won't be there. Now, does unbelief mean that you have to be an avowed atheist? No. Are there people that claim belief in God but aren't really believers? Well, we've been talking about that. I mean, and so many of those examples. Was King Saul an atheist? No, he wasn't. But did he have faith in God? Well, what is a faith that is that will save us? What kind of faith? When God speaks of faith, what is believing or unbelieving? Faith versus unbelief. Again, whose definition are we going to use? It absolutely produces action. Otherwise, what is it? James chapter 2. We can go over there for a moment in James 2. We have to find what God's definition is for all of these things. That's why we go to these different scriptures to see that. Brother Lawrence?
I was thinking of Peter when he got out of the boat. But then he sank because of his unbelief and his doubt.
Yeah, and that would be another example where fear came in that became an obstacle for his faith. But right, with his doubt, then if we're doubting the Lord and his word in any situation, we're not going to be able to fulfill his will and please him. But that connection with our faith and acting upon it to do what God's will is, that is absolutely required by God's definition. In fact, it's part of the definition, his definition of faith. It's easy for us to define that. We're thinking, well, faith means just in our minds we believe something, that it's a fact. Well, we have to have that part of it, but that's not the end of it. Because there are, he's going to speak about this in James 2. Are devils, is Satan an atheist? Let's just ask it like that. Is Satan an atheist? They believe and tremble. That's right here in James 2:19. Satan is not an atheist. He knows there's a God. And all of his angels, all the devils, know that there's a God. They also know that Jesus Christ is his son. And we have many examples in the when Christ was on the earth, when he cast devils out of different ones, where the devils confessed who he was, where he would tell them to hold their peace. It was not God's will for who Christ was to be revealed by devils. Remember in Matthew 16 when he said, whom do you say that I am? He asked to his apostles, and Peter said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus said, blessed art thou, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood hath not revealed this to you, but my Father which is in heaven. That's the way it was supposed to be. That was to be revealed from God, not through devils, which is why Jesus told them to hold their peace. But there were many times when the devils confessed what they knew to be true, that there is a God and Jesus Christ is his son. So that puts the devils actually ahead of a lot of people, doesn't it? Which is sad. But he tells us about what a living faith is here in James chapter 2. Let's go ahead and read verses 14. Let's go ahead and read 14 to 26 there. Let's see. Trey, you got that? Can you do that? James 2, 14 to 26.
If a brother if it hath not works is dead, being alone. Yea, man may say, thou hast faith, and I have works. Show me thy faith without thy works, and I will show thee my faith by thy works. Thou believest that there is one God. Thou doest well. The devils also believe and tremble. What wilt thou know, O vain man, that faith without works is dead? Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he had offered Isaac his son upon the altar? Seest thou how faith wrought with his works, and by works was faith made perfect? And scripture was fulfilled which saith, Abraham believed God, and it was imputed unto him for righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. Ye see then how that by works a man is justified, but not by faith only. Likewise also was Rahab the harlot justified by works, when she had received the messengers, and had sent them out another way. For as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also.
I mean, he hits that from a bunch of angles in there, but that first application of verse 14, somebody is lacking in clothing or shelter, food, and we tell that person, I hope, be warm, be filled. And if we have food, if we have, I mean, it's kind of, this would be a night where we could appreciate that a little bit more. I mean, somebody's out, well, I know Ann forgot her coat tonight, but if somebody goes out in this cold rain and they don't have a coat, and you got something that you could give them to make them warm and dry, and then you just say, well, I hope somehow you get to be warm and dry, and then you don't provide what could help them in that, and all you do is say something but don't do anything, I mean, what is it going to profit them? Are your words going to keep them dry? Are your words going to warm them up? Are your words going to fill them? I mean, that doesn't do anything if that's all we do. Now, taking from that example, he says, even so, faith, if it has not works, is dead being alone. Faith all by itself that doesn't do anything is dead. And that's why he gives that example. I mean, how do we show our faith? How do we show that we believe? By just saying that we do? Now, some people try to put faith and works of obedience as if they oppose each other. And so here he says, yet a man may say, thou hast faith and I have works. So are you in the works camp or the faith camp? Well, that's a false argument. Those two things aren't mutually exclusive. They're not in opposition to each other at all. That's why he says there in verse 18, show me thy faith without thy works, and I will show thee my faith by my works. How do we demonstrate that we really believe God? If we live our lives no different than someone who doesn't believe in the Lord at all, and there's no difference in the way we live and the things we do, and we just say we believe, but they say they don't. I mean, if there's no difference in how we live and what we do, how are we any different? And that's why he gives that example of verse 19. Thou believest that there's one God, thou doest well. The devils also believe and tremble. If it's only belief in our minds, if that's as far as it goes, and it doesn't produce any action, well, that's the devils. They know there's a God. They absolutely know it. And they know who Jesus is, that he's the Son of God. They know that. They believe that. But are devils doing God's will? No, they're opposing it. That's what makes them devils. But if we only believe in our minds, well, the devils do that, and we're no different than they are then. That's not the camp we want to be in. And that's why he says even that faith without works is dead. He repeats that in verse 20 and gives the example of Abraham, how faith wrought with his works, and by his works his faith was made perfect. That word means complete. Faith that lacks works is incomplete and dead. A faith that's demonstrated by action in doing God's will is complete and it's alive. So when he says the unbelieving, it's not just those who reject any idea that there is a God or that Jesus is the Son of God. They may say that they believe those things, like the devils did. But if that's as far as our faith goes, we're not going to be in that city four square for eternity. We have to have actions there that go along with our faith, so that we're not just like the devils. Well, Jesus also said this in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 21. Brother Stephen, can you read that Matthew 7 verse 21?
Not everyone that says unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven.
Is it just something that we have to believe in our minds or even say with our mouths? I may believe in my mind that he is Lord. He is. And I may even say that. But if that's as far as it goes, is that going to get me there into that eternal city with him? Or does he say, not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, will enter into the kingdom of heaven? Who will? He that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. This is at the very end of the Sermon on the Mount. And he gives the next thing right after that verse, right after from verse 21, he goes on to speak about that wise man who built his house on a rock, and then a foolish man who built it on sand. And when a storm hit it, it collapsed. And I know our children, they all know that song, "The Wise Man Built His House Upon a Rock." It's good they know those words. I like to ask them, now, what does that mean? Because they know the words of that song, but what about the application of that? Who did Jesus say was like that wise man? And who was like that foolish man? Well, that wise man in Matthew 7:24, he says, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them. That's building that house on the rock. What about the those who hear his sayings and don't do them? That's what verse 26 says. Everyone that heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them not, that's the foolish man. That house is going to fall. So we have to hear what he says, believe that. Again, that's Romans 10:17, and then we have to act upon that. We have to demonstrate that faith with our actions and doing God's will and serving him. We don't earn our salvation. The scriptures don't teach that. But this is something that God requires as a condition, that we serve him and do his will. Luke 6, verse 46. Brother Ted, can you read Luke 6 and verse 46? All right, so there's a good question. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say? What does the word Lord mean? It's one that possesses authority. So when we use that term, we're acknowledging that he has authority over us. Well, what good are those words if we're saying, yeah, I know you have authority, you are my Lord, you have authority over me, but I'm not going to submit to it? I mean, why would we call him Lord and not do what he says? So we can look at many other examples like that, but the Lord requires faith, and he requires a faith with action and obedience. Hebrews 5 verse 9, Jesus Christ is the author of eternal salvation unto whom? To all them that obey him. So that all goes together. So otherwise, we can't enter that city. What's the third thing in Revelation 21 verse 8? Fearful, unbelieving, the abominable. Well, that's not a word that we use a whole lot in modern English, but what does it mean? Well, if you look up the Greek words for abominable, it means detestable or disgusting. That's really what it means. And it comes from the root Greek word for abominable is the Greek word that means to stink. So think about that. Something that stinks. Of course, he's talking about here now with behavior. But it's something that, and we all know if there's something that smells rotten, I'll tell you that, I see a lot of stuff, and I'm not going to go into details, but I see a lot of stuff in hospitals, but I tell you what, smells bother me more than anything, far more than stuff I see. I think we can relate to that. I mean, it's just something is really, that's hard to bear, something that's really has an awful odor to it. It'll make us, we'll have a face of disgust that'll show in our very expressions. But that the word abominable comes from that. And so here he says the abominable are going to have their part in the lake of fire. Well, what does it mean to be abominable in a spiritual sense? Well, one thing that Jesus says about it in Luke 16 and verse 15 is that it's the opposite of what God esteems. See, Brother Dave, can you read Luke 16, verse 15? Actually, go ahead and read 13 through 15 so we can see the context there and a good application.
No servant can serve two masters, or either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. He cannot serve God and man. And the Pharisees also, who were covetous, heard all these things, and they derided him. And he said unto them, ye are they which justify yourselves before men, but God knoweth your hearts, for that which is highly esteemed among men is abomination in the sight of God.
All right, so what is highly esteemed among men is abomination in the sight of God. What men think, what they think is great, it's disgusting to God. We can think of lots of examples of that. We have many of them in our present world. There's an application right here, though, of that principle. We cannot serve God and mammon, which is material things. A love of money and material things, money, the things that it buys. Now, in the world, what does it mean to be successful in the world? I saw that on somebody had a t-shirt on, it's been a while, but I saw it, and they had on there, say, whoever dies with the most toys wins. And that pretty much encapsulates the idea, doesn't it? That with the way people think. I mean, basically, when you leave this world, if you have accumulated, whoever's gotten the most while they were here, you know, they're the winner. That's the way men think. That's how success is defined. Opposite, again, to what God says. And we remember Luke 12 when that man came to Jesus and was pleading with him to make his brother to divide the inheritance with him. So here they were squabbling over an inheritance. People don't do that anymore, do they? what's at the root of that? Covetousness. And Jesus, that was his answer. He said, man, who made me a judge or divider over you? He said, beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth. That's what Jesus said. So by Christ's definition of success, does it have anything to do with how much material wealth that we gain in this life? No. And a love for that and serving, if that's what we're serving, if that's what we're loving, if that's what we desire life and love many days for so that we can try to see and get more stuff, this is a great time of year to be preaching that, isn't it? But if that's our mind, that's not at all what the Lord esteems. That's an abomination to him. They derided Christ, those ones who heard those words there in Luke 16. It says they were covetous. They loved their things. And so when Jesus said, you can't serve God and mammon, they derided him for it. Now, if you get a gang of people to mock what God says and laugh at it and speak against it, does that make it go away? Does that invalidate it? Does it make it untrue? How many people, what's the number of people that you could get together to decide to vote against something that God has said in His Word and that means they get to change it? What's that number? There isn't one. However many people we have on the earth today, seven whatever point, whatever billion that it is now, is seven, but if you get 7 billion people that disagree with God, do they suddenly become right and God wrong? Or does the Lord say, let God be true and every man a liar? God's always right, and there's nothing that man can do to change what God says. We should also remember, we have, before we close here, Proverbs chapter 6. We have a very important passage where the Lord tells us some things that are very specifically an abomination to Him. What is highly esteemed among men is abomination in the sight of God. What God esteems is an abomination to man. So we see how the wisdom of men and the wisdom of God, those two things are incompatible. But here's the wisdom of God speaking in Proverbs chapter 6, verses 16 through 19. Brother Glenn, here are some of the things, and these aren't the only things that are abominations to God, but he's highlighting here some of the things that are particularly abominable to Him, and these are things we need to know and stay away from.
These six things doth the Lord hate, yea, seven are abominations to Him: proud look, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, and heart that deviseth wicked imaginations, feet that be swift in running to mischief, a false witness that speaks lies, and he that sows discord among brethren.
Now, which of those seven things can keep us out of heaven? That's the right answer. That's right, all of them. And the Lord tells us in Revelation 21, that verse 8, that the abominable are going to have their part in the lake of fire. Well, what is that? Well, here's some of those things. We need to put away all of those things there. And he's going to mention some of those things here separately in Revelation 21 and verse 8, such as a lying tongue, because he says all liars are going to have their part in that lake that burns with fire and brimstone. But pride, lying, hands that shed innocent blood, heart that devises wicked imaginations, feet that be swift in running to mischief, a false witness that speaks lies, and he that sows discord among brethren. Any of those things, and all of those things, are abominations to God. And like I said, this isn't all the things that are abominable to Him, but anything that's against His will be. But this would be a good passage to keep in mind, because we know for certain that engaging in those things and having our lives with those things in it will be an obstacle for us to be able to go to heaven. Well, there's a bit more left in Revelation 21 and verse 8. The next thing he's going to mention is murderers, which is kind of included in part of that list there in Proverbs 6. Hands that shed innocent blood, and but even if it's not innocent blood, we're not to engage in murder. And one of the things that we'll see in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, does this mean it's something that we actually have to engage in a literal or a physical sense? What did Jesus say if we're angry with our brother without cause? See, can we be guilty of some of these things or any of these things in our hearts? So if we have hatred and anger in our hearts towards others, even though we may not have, and hopefully we would not physically kill them, but just like he's going to speaks about lust in the heart, and that's committing adultery in the heart. That's going to come up. They're whoremongers. There's a lot of these things, and when the Lord teaches by His standards, it doesn't have to be carried to the extreme of action, but it starts in the thoughts, and having those, having that in our hearts is going to make us guilty before Him. So that's where the battle has to be waged there. You know, obviously we must stay away from the actions of any of these things, but we have to start there. In our minds and win the battle there with our thoughts, so that we don't fall to any of those temptations even there, so that we're not guilty of doing those things in our hearts. But we want to look at that some more, Lord willing, next Wednesday night. But very, very glad to have everybody here this evening, and look forward to studying some more of these things together next time.